Life Show. I'm Robin Daly, and the show focuses around developments in integrative medicine for cancer. It's called the Yes to Life Show after the UK charity Yes to Life that helps people with cancer to access appropriate integrative medicine. I'm very excited about today's interview, which is with a doctor in Texas who has brought together some existing techniques to create a completely new form of photodynamic therapy, or PDT. PDT is already established as a cheap, effective treatment for some cancers with very few or no side effects. But Dr. Matthew Godavan's discoveries look set to give PDT the potential to help vast numbers of people with cancer. I'm talking to Dr. Godavan over Skype at San Antonio University in Texas. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to talk to you today about photodynamic therapy. PDT has long been something I bang on about because really I'm absolutely disgusted by the way its potential is just continually overlooked, certainly in this country, and marginalised to the detriment of people with cancer. So I want people to know about it. The public's completely used to hearing of regular breakthroughs in respect of cancer treatment, but the reality is one of ever-increasing incidence, spiralling costs, incremental progress, and the omnipresent treatment side effects, which are often worse than the disease itself. So within this context, how excited should we be about the developments that you've been working on?
I think that, and I share some of those similar concerns that you've expressed, that photodynamic therapy, as you said, has been around for quite a long time, and our technology, as we can discuss later, is a little bit of a deviation on the sort of standard PDT, but I mean the overall efficacy of PDT, the lower, relatively lower cost, and I think too perhaps the lack of some of these damaging side effects from the standard of care with surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. I think we should be really looking to PDT to a bit more to treat some of these cancers.
Okay. So this is your field of research. And I mean, treatment with light sort of sounds to a lot of people very futuristic, but in fact, it's more than a century old. Tragically, most people don't actually know about it. They know little or nothing about it. So I'd like to start with the fundamentals, basically, of what PDT is, how it was developed originally, and then we can go on and look at your new research. So could you just tell us a bit about where it all comes from?
Well, I think, as you said, and historically over 100 years ago, we were activating compounds with specific wavelengths of light. So a compound could have a certain relatively narrow wavelength of light that it would cause it to do something. And that led to the development of photodynamic therapy for treatments. And one of the treatments that it sort of seemed to be effective at least initially, was cancer, because the current photodynamic therapy takes a drug or a compound that, when activated by light, turns the oxygen in the body to reactive oxygen. It's sort of a simple, basic approach, and that reactive oxygen starts to damage cell membranes and to break up DNA and causes death. And so it's a nice approach in the sense that the drug is sort of selectively taken up by cancer, and all you have to do is only aim the light at the cancer. So we have pretty sophisticated imaging. It's been widely used for decades for skin lesions and skin cancers in the dermatology space, and it's grabbed some traction in esophageal cancers and head and neck cancers, those cancers that are easily accessible and relatively close to the surface. It hasn't really been employed, and I think there's some clinical limitations for deeper cancers within the body, like pancreatic, liver, and lung. And I think there's some relatively new advances, and certainly what we're doing could lend itself towards that.
Okay, well, I'd be very interested to hear some more about that. Yes, the basic mechanisms you spoke about there of the way the PDC works. So, as you say, there's some sort of drug which is called a photosensitizer or a photodynamic agent, which is given to a patient, and some agents are much better than others, and there are particular features you're looking for in these agents, aren't there? Would you like to explain a bit about the features that you actually want from these agents?
Well, one of the things that's desirable is for the agent to be selectively taken up by rapidly dividing cells.
Okay.
That's one of the key features. And cancer is the, in a patient with cancer, that's going to be some of their most rapidly dividing cells. You know, your skin cells divide pretty rapidly. Your hair cells will divide fairly rapidly and so forth. But the cancer cell, so it's sort of selectively taken up there. And then what you're hoping for is a photosensitizer that can be activated with a wavelength of light that will penetrate deep enough to reach the tumor. So ultraviolet light and sort of the natural ambient light that we see in our visible spectrum doesn't penetrate terribly deep, but it can penetrate deep enough to affect a photosensitizing cream on the skin for skin cancers. And it can penetrate deep enough into the head and neck region and even into some tumors that are fairly superficial and accessible.
And these agents, they've varied quite a lot over time. I mean, they've been developed for features like their ability to select fast dividing cells. Could you say a bit about the different agents that have developed over time and where they've come from?
Well, yeah, and I can see sort of the evolution of these agents as they've come into at least the United States into the clinical setting always stem from a previous agent that had a limitation. So basic scientists and physicians worked to overcome some of those things. A photofrin is a name of one of the agents that is commonly used. It is rapidly taken up by dividing cells, and it's activated by a red light. So you can use a relatively inexpensive laser. You know, when we say laser, people think we're going to shoot laser beams and blind people. Yeah. The energy that comes out of the laser just gives us the wavelength we need. It's in fact, sometimes the energy is so low that it doesn't even cause any irritation to your skin. You'd get more irritation sitting out in the sun for an hour. Right. And so those are some of the features. So, you know, what wavelength of light and what power do we have to use to activate it? I could say there's some new technology in photodynamic therapy that involves taking, and it's called active targeting. So the photosensitizing drug is attached to a molecule that acts like a key, and it searches around the entire body, and it only fits in one lock, and that lock is usually on the surface of cancer. So it'll go right past all the healthy cells, and when they attach to their lock and key type mechanism, once the key is in there, the cell pulls it inside. That's a known physiological response for anything when a molecule binds to a receptor. So there's a more of a targeted. So different clinical trials going on in the United States right now in phase 1 and phase 2A, head and neck cancer, involve using an antigen antibody lock and key type fit specific to head and neck tumors. And then the clinicians know that should be the only place where the drug is.
Right.
And then they wait so many hours and shine the light into that area. So those are ongoing.
So that's hyper-selective, really, isn't it? That's going to be like the gold standard in selectivity, isn't it, if it's actually using a mechanism like that?
Yeah, and so maybe restate myself a little bit here. You look for a lock and key that's unique to cancer, and if you can't find one, most of the cancers will have a receptor that other cells may have, but they express 10,000 times that receptor. It's still not an issue in clinical application because if you know a patient has prostate cancer and the nanoparticle may go to other parts of the body, your selectivity then comes in the fact that you're only delivering this activating beam of light to the cancer. Very discreetly as well.
Right. So you've got two controllable things. One is where the actual drug is taken up, and the other one is where you actually apply the laser or the light.
Absolutely. We call it two layers of selectivity and specificity to give us precision that obviously is not seen in chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is really, drugs that will work very effectively on your cancer, but also maybe aren't quite as selective and destroy other healthy parts of the body.
Which, of course, has always been the shortcoming with them, and it's always been the thing that people have been battling to improve on, but
it hasn't been.
And I could share with your audience that one of the more recent and exciting aspects of the reactive oxygen photodynamic therapy and some of the work that we're doing, which is a completely different form of photodynamic therapy, indicates that there's a likelihood that the photodynamic therapy itself generates a systemic immune response. So, for example, if a mouse had a tumor on its left chest and you put another tumor on its right chest and you only treated one side, the other side will start to shrink. So what you're doing, what we believe, and there's some evidence of this, that the photodynamic therapy treatment to the primary source of the cancer activates the immune system, so the T cells now recognize that cell, and to be able to have a local therapy trigger a systemic response to deal with metastatic cancer is just a huge breakthrough.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I had down to talk to you about, because I'm very interested in that aspect of there seems to be a very attractive offer, obviously, for someone, is if they've got a tumor and it can be surgically removed, then, well, let's have it out. But actually, there are benefits, aren't there, to actually treating within the body. And I've heard this in other fields as well, but particularly in PDT, that, yes, you're actually waking the immune system up in a way that will help you with your long-term recovery, probably, and ensure that you deal effectively with any remaining cancer, because, of course, the tumor is not the only site of cancer cells in your body.
Right, and so, and you know, I'm not a clinician and I'm not an oncologist, but I can say that from experiences in my family, right now, my mother is a stage 3 colon cancer survivor at 83 years old. And she's doing very well with her treatment. Right. Not all patients are candidates for surgery. No. I mean, even something as a dangerously high blood pressure eliminates you as a candidate for surgery.
Right.
The other thing is that when you look at having a photodynamic therapy trigger the immune system to specifically kill those cancer cells, there is some evidence that some of these new drugs that are called checkpoint inhibitors that try to manipulate your immune system, and boy, if they don't get it right, they'll actually cause cancer to grow in other places.
Right.
So you know, and I sort of share your opinion. I think we're really just on the brink of trying to get more attention to the value of photodynamic therapy. I know that it's got limited traction here in the United States.
Right. And out of interest, what's your opinion on which of the two parts of the process is actually triggering the immune system? Is it simply that cancer cells are dying within the body, or is it something specific to the photodynamic therapy?
From my knowledge and what I've read, the cell suicide pathway of apoptosis, which much of the photodynamic therapy triggers, followed by the necrosis, it's when the cellular contents spew out into that extracellular space.
Right.
And the T cells now recognize little pieces of it. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that other types of treatments don't trigger that. There's some evidence that simply radiation therapy treatments, when you hit the primary tumor, can elicit a small and short-lived immune response.
Right.
The one with photodynamic therapy seems to be absent of all that heat damage.
Right.
Radiation has tremendous heat damage. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's really good hope there for, in the literature, we see it as, oh, hey, we noticed it sort of as a side effect. Mm-hmm. But scientists are now intentionally trying to not only kill the primary tumor with the PDT, but actually accentuate and drive an immune response. Mm-hmm. Because if you do that sort of secondarily, you're hopefully just driving an immune response just for those cells. And so you wouldn't really create any sort of situation where healthy cells would be.
Exactly.
The body would turn on itself.
Very important. You're really taking advantage of the kind of sophistication of the immune system.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So I wanted to ask a bit about the light sources. You've already mentioned quite a few different kinds of light. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what sources of light have been used, are being used, and why.
Well, so, and again, I said, you know, we can use lasers anywhere from in the ultraviolet range, not visible. The common wavelength is a red light. It comes out of a laser in the 600 nanometer range. The lasers just offer a lot more control and pinpoint accuracy. They're easy to connect to fiber optic lines, so that a lot of times we have to put an array of photo optic sort of lines in there, sort of light things up. The newer technology and the technology that we are taking advantage of involves what they call near infrared light, which would be higher in its wavelength than 980 nanometers, so you're still not visible. But so the basic premise is the higher the wavelength, the deeper the penetration.
Okay.
So with our technology, we say with the current reactive oxygen PDT, a centimeter depth is a good depth to have the photosensitizer have that light penetrate into it. The near infrared is at a higher wavelength, and it'll penetrate 7.5 centimeters. So you're getting this huge penetration. It'll go right through.
Yeah.
So that gives an opportunity to say cancers that currently didn't have a PDT option, just deeper in the body, or even just on the morphology of a patient that's a bigger person, a heavier person, mm-hmm. that's got a deeper tissue to penetrate through. And there's also evidence that if the, you know, we're always told that drugs won't cross the blood-brain barrier. And so a patient can take a drug, but it depends how it gets. And we're learning tremendous numbers of articles, research articles, showing that the things that do cross the blood-brain barrier can be drugs where there's a tumor, because in the brain, the tumor is so vascular, it's actually kind of leaky.
Right.
So things can leak out. Well, this deeper penetrating light can go right through your skull and travel, you know, 5 to 7 centimeters into your brain. Okay. It doesn't damage or do any damage to any tissue on its way in. And when it reaches that site, some of the earlier nanoparticle technology were little gold nanoparticles. You heated them up and they cooked your tumor. So this is a different technology. It's more about the physics of light and the activation of some of these particles.
Interesting. And how about LEDs? Because they're used for some surface work, I understand.
Yeah, especially in the dermatology space and in some of the skin cancers, they're very effective. Again, when you look at the wavelength of light that you can deliver, with a laser, you can deliver more energy. But again, like I said, a lot of these sensitizers don't need a tremendous amount of energy. And so, especially in a dermatological setting, you don't have to be worried about lasers. And they have a blue light that's like a dome that goes over the patient's head. They stick their face in there if they've got what's actinic keratosis, which is like a precursor to skin cancer. So they can treat that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, regardless of those sources, they're relatively inexpensive. I think too, as a scientist and trying to develop something for easing the suffering of human patients, I'm also looking at maybe the potential to ease the workload on healthcare workers that have to deal with the patients, and all the side effects from the return visits and the burden to the economic portion of the healthcare system for people mm-hmm. coming back with disease-related illnesses from chemo and radiation. And you look at something that seems to be relatively simple, and really we're hoping that we can sort of push some of its acceptance in the clinic.
Mm. Well, I certainly hope so. When you look at the options, when PDT is a viable option, which it can quite often be, the difference in the patient experience is like night and day, really, isn't it, between standard treatment and having PDT?
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly... like you said earlier, and there's sort of a stereotype. If a patient has a tumor that hasn't metastasized, they want to see it cut out of their body and thrown in the garbage.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know that. The surgeon can cut it out and it's in the trash and it's never coming back. And if you tell them, well, we're going to basically dissolve it with this chemical and this light, I think they're a little skeptical, even though the results is depending on the nature of the tumor. It could be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there just needs to be more education, and as more patients choose PDT for less scarring and less pain and less post-operative potential infections and trauma, we may see it start to shift.
And possibly immune system benefit as well. So, yeah, there's so many pluses. Not least of all, of course, it's cheap compared with a lot of orthodox therapy. Now, this is a bit of a sort of a personal question, if you like, but it's just something that struck me long ago, that PDT could just be one of nature's ways of keeping us cancer-free anyway. I mean, some of the best photosensitizers have been based on chlorophyll, which we all know is at the heart of our good green veg. And we know that eating our greens is a great strategy for staying cancer-free, as is exposure to sunlight. And could there be a natural form of PDT going on here in our bodies all the time?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly for... So the penetrance into the tissue of sunlight wouldn't be terribly deep, but it certainly would. Here's my reaction.
Okay.
If a patient didn't eat their chlorophyll and spent time out in the sun, they might be more likely to get skin cancer than a person that was experiencing sort of a natural sort of PDT for those more superficial types of cancers.
Anyway, just a little personal thought there. So you're looking to push the boundaries of PDT to make it from being pretty non-invasive to being completely non-invasive, really. So, I mean, efforts are made, certainly in this country, when it is used, to get laser light inside the body to treat cancers, which is invasive to an extent. But you're now proposing a method of PDT, which really, as you say, has got sufficient penetration to do away with the need for that. Has it got a name, this new generation of PDT?
Yeah, well, so as a sort of a disclaimer, all of the PDT that we've been discussing uses the creation of reactive oxygen to destroy cells.
Okay.
In my laboratory at UT San Antonio, we developed a way to cause light activation acidosis.
Okay.
So in a very exciting way, we're taking well-known technologies and sort of combining them in a very novel way. Our photosensitizer is called nitrobenzaldehyde, and when it is hit with a certain wavelength of light, it carries with it a hydrogen ion that will cause acidosis. So we are calling our new version of PDT light-activated intracellular acidosis. Once the compound crosses into the cell membrane and we shine the light on the cell can undergo a rapid and profound acidosis from which it cannot recover.
Okay.
And cancer cells are known to have sort of an extra arsenal of acid and pH regulatory proteins. In other words, they thrive in areas where most cells would die. They're very acidic and environment and very low in oxygen. And so the cells are made to be, from the inside, so acidic that they rapidly say, I can't fight this. I go into my programmed cell death mode and I kill myself. And we showed that in a recent peer-reviewed manuscript that just came out in seminars in cancer biology. We showed that this light-activated intracellular acidosis is not cancer-specific. We killed two forms of breast cancer, including triple-negative breast cancer, two forms of prostate cancer, and a cell line of pancreatic cancer, all through this similar mechanism, making them acidic to the point where they can't recover.
Mm-hmm.
We then gave mice triple-negative breast cancer and showed that the treatment also arrested the growth of the triple-negative tumors. So I think that that's really important for the audience to understand is that if we are developing something that is, to me, it's just relatively simple, but that the cells, no cell can escape. All we have to do is find a way to get the photosensitizing compound into the cells we want and deliver the light. We, we transitioned now recently to the production of a nanoparticle.
Okay.
Can I just describe that briefly?
Please do, yeah.
The nanoparticle is obviously a very tiny rare earth metal in which our photosensitizer is attached to the surface of it. And then the nanoparticle is coated in a protein. Sometimes the scientists will use a protein from the red blood cells. So now it's cloaked. It can go in the body. It won't cross into any cells, but it also won't be attacked by the body because it has sort of a human cloaking on it. And then using active targeting on the surface of that particle, we would put the key, looking for the lock on the cancer. Okay. This allows what we call precision medicine. So we're currently developing nanoparticles for prostate cancer with a specific, you know, targeting molecule. Breast cancer would have a different targeting molecule. And so these agents could be directed, these nanoparticles are injected directly into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. They would travel to the tumor where it's leaky, and they would leak out. They would stick to their receptor on the surface of the cancer and be brought inside. Once inside, we have now quite a distance that we can shine this light from the outside of the body and photoactivate that compound. And so I think the importance here is that we can fabricate nanoparticles to target cancer, so we spare healthy cells. Even in prostate cancer, there's a concern about all the nerves in that area, damaging healthy tissue. Postoperative concerns with surgery are is a big problem. So we develop a nanoparticle that's targeted to a specific cancer that the patient has. We're moving away from some of the clinical limitations of reactive oxygen. Reactive oxygen relies on oxygen in the tumor, and they're relying on oxygen in a tumor that's very low in oxygen. Yes. Our drug brings the hydrogen with it, so we should have a more consistent dosing sort of efficacy approach. And as well, we're overcoming a potential limitation on how deep the tumor is. Mm. As we can have a light that penetrates very deep to photoactivate the particle. And the other exciting aspect for us is that these nanoparticles, we can sort of attach lots of little things on the surface. So again, to my point earlier, we're designing experiments to not only measure if we're invoking a systemic immune response, but intentionally putting things on there to elicit an immune response to those cancer cells. Our particle goes inside the cell. So we already have now sort of a little spy on the inside.
Right.
And when we activate it, we're trying to really sort of, like I said, intentionally control what we're doing in that environment.
So what would you be putting there to activate the immune system?
Well, so there's a whole host of ideas that are out there right now that people could do. And so what we're looking at is we know that once the cells start to die, they express a marker on their surface, and the macrophages of the immune system go and recycle their parts. So we know we're bringing the immune system to the cancer site. So it's a question of trying to activate T cells in the area to sort of recognize some antigen. So you want to sort of have there's an army of soldiers standing around, but they haven't been given any orders. We want to give them the order to recognize this, and then to go seek it out wherever it resides in a patient that has metastasized cancer. That could be really a breakthrough platform technology.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So it's very interesting. So in a way, you're making specific agents for specific cancers, but the treatment's the same treatment. It doesn't matter what the cancer is. It's going to work because it's one process, basically, that you're using. It's just the kind of the mechanism for finding the right cells to treat that you're altering.
Right. And so the process by which the cells die through this light activation is intracellular acidosis. And that's something that has never been proposed before for PDT. It's known that acidosis can kill cancer cells. Mm. It's been sort of the foundation of some chemotherapeutics, but unfortunately, those chemotherapeutics devastate the rest of the body.
I got you. So tell me, say you have prostate cancer with secondaries. Is the same mechanism going to work with the secondaries as with the primary?
No, that's a great question. I think what we're thinking now as we move into the future is that the primary tumor would be treated with the nanoparticle and the light-activated intracellular acidosis. Mm-hmm. Then we're hoping to invoke and really trigger the patient's own immune system to go after the secondaries.
I see.
And I think one of the things that's important, and we were talking about this earlier, the way that you're told you have tumors in a secondary location, you could be feeling fine. At least in my experiences with the CAT scan. But that tumor has to be a certain size before it'll even come up.
Right.
And so if you treat a patient's primary tumor and say, well, you know, we don't know if it's anywhere else, but if it is, this is a really good safeguard, you know, to have some treatments in which the primary tumor dies from the acidosis. And if any of them metastasize and got out that are too small to detect with the current technology that we have, we're comfortable that the immune system response, as it's exaggerated, would go and find them and destroy them.
Mm.
So the nanoparticle would never go to the secondaries.
Right. Okay. Well, it's a great concept. I hope you're as successful with it as it's looking. Okay. And just out of interest, so you're making specific agents for specific cancers. Well, how specific does this get? I mean, there are, I don't know how many different kinds of breast cancer there are. 80 something, is it? Do you have to do one for every kind or what?
Well, again, we would look at, the first question is there a receptor on these cancer cells that is unique to them?
Mm-hmm.
There are some forms of brain cancer that express receptors only unique to them. Prostate cancer cells express the prostate-specific antigen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a target. So that's the first question. The next question is, well, if it doesn't express a receptor that's unique to itself, what is it overexpressing? Is it expressing a receptor that other tissue has, but it's expressing it much, much greater levels? And I can say, and we can look in the literature, epidermal growth factor receptor 1, it's called EGRF. It's expressed on all cells, cell types, but overexpressed in breast cancer.
Hmm.
That's the advantage then, is now we have the specificity of the targeting. And if we know, well, that nanoparticle may be going someplace else, but we're only directing light at the tumor. So that's where the focal nature of the treatment comes in.
I see.
When you talked about breast cancer, there's many different forms. There's triple negative. There's all these estrogen positive, negative. Mm-hmm. That characteristic doesn't really matter so much to us, as long as we say, what kind of receptor are you expressing on your surface that we can tag and exploit? Because it'll kill anything. As a matter of fact, some of the earliest studies I did, I killed healthy non-cancerous cells.
Right. So this doesn't really go to the level of kind of personalized medicine that's actually looking at particular genes for in particular patients. It's much more about cancer types, which is kind of the way that medicine has looked at cancer for a long time. Of course, it's much simpler in some ways, because it's not having to actually prescribe by the patient. It's more by the group of patients. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, and I like the advances in some of the precision medicine where a patient has a type of cancer, but it's got a certain gene deletion that can be detected, and maybe there's a better approach for that person with a chemotherapeutic or whatnot. But you're right, our approach doesn't really pay much attention to that. What our approach pays attention to is, can I get my nanoparticle into your cancer, and can I get the beam of light onto the cancer? And especially talking with interventional radiologists who don't believe there is any part of the human body they can't reach with a beam of light or a scope, they're incredibly optimistic and interested in trying this. So we are in the preclinical phase right now. I can tell you I have a fantastic team of students here at UT San Antonio. They are, often we hear of patients that do very well with chemotherapy, and then 5 to 7 years later, the cancer has burned, and now it's resistant to that same drug. It's exactly. a multi-drug resistant cancer.
Yeah.
And so we believe that our technology could kill anything. So we believe it could kill multi-drug resistant cancer. So the students in the laboratory are creating a drug resistant strain of a prostate cancer.
Okay.
With the idea that probably before Christmas, we'll be testing our technology and its ability to kill that. We're in the preclinical phase of doing all the animal testing and working very hard to translate this into a commercial setting for the clinic.
Mm-hmm. So the potential here is to have an enormous impact in treating particularly people for whom there are not many other great options, like somebody who's got a resistant tumor, like you've just described. Ones that can't be given taken out by surgery, all sorts of situations of people with secondaries who would normally be considered as terminal.
I would also add, I listened to your program earlier, one of your programs with Dr. Harper. We're tending to think of this in terms of, Europe and the United States, but South America, they don't have surgical suites at the same abundance that we do.
Right.
there are patients that would really not even be offered that as a treatment.
Right.
They could, almost in a somewhat portable way, have a clinic set up to do PDT.
Mm. Well, it's extraordinary how cheaply PDT can be set up and administered, isn't it? That's one of the things that Colin Hopper made clear. I was literally yes. gobsmacked by when he told me, I think it was £8,000 for the setup and £200 of treatment. Extraordinary.
Yeah. I started I founded a biotech startup company to develop this commercially, and chose very carefully the team of people that I would work with. And when I was putting things together, I'm not a business person, I said to a group of potential investors, do you know that the amount of nitrobenzaldehyde that you need to destroy a tumor the size of my thumb costs about a nickel?
Right.
5 cents.
Yeah.
And they said, well, don't tell anybody that.
Yeah, well, that's it, really, isn't it?
You know, they don't. The investors don't want it to be cheap. They want it to be expensive. Yeah. Our approach is that we are working very hard to develop this for phase 1 clinical trials, and to then probably in breast or prostate as our first indication, and then to continue to drive the technology and bring other cancer types into Food and Drug Administration approval as a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And deliver something that maybe isn't out there. You know, patients that in adolescence, clinicians are very reluctant to give them a teenager radiotherapy because it'll kill their tumor, but they'll have cancer when they're 40 all over their body.
Of course.
Some patients exceed the dose of radiation. And then, you know, I say this, my mother went for her diagnosis after some assessments of a tumor. She had part of her colon removed. You don't want to hear the physician say, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. And unfortunately, people hear that and would really like to say, you're in a situation where you can't have surgery or radiation, but there's this new technology that is in clinical trials. I know the first place that we can develop something to help people is in clinical trials. That's my focus, phase 1 clinical trials.
Okay, brilliant. So a couple of questions about that. We're saying that PDT can actually be done very cheaply, far too cheaply, actually, to be of interest. Your process is different. Is it more expensive than standard PDT?
I would say the light sources are equivalent in their cost, so it's not any more expensive.
Right.
Production and fabrication of nanoparticles, maybe several other steps than some of the reactive oxygen photosensitizers. But they're also attaching markers on them as well. So no, I don't really think – I can't foresee it being that much different in cost. Yeah. And what we're hoping is that the – we often think that the customer is the patient.
Right.
The customer is the person that's paying for it.
Right.
So you also have to convince healthcare entities –
yeah.
The hospitals, the insurance companies, the people that can pay for it, you have something that's better. And again, on your archive show, it was a really great when they talked about that cost analysis of return visits to burden the healthcare providers and the cost on a healthcare system because of the side effects. Would we be able to demonstrate a significant breakthrough on that part as well?
Mm.
Treating the cancer, even if it was the same as surgery, chemo, or radiation.
Right. Well, you've got a better model in the US for bringing in innovation, I think, in the business model of healthcare than we have here with the state model of healthcare, which is extremely resistant to change and has lots of sort of vested interests. I think that's one of our greater problems here. And I think I'm not sure about the state of PDT in the States, but I get the impression it's being used more there than it is here.
I would say in looking back in history, it sort of reached a peak in its head and neck and esophageal cancer and skin cancer. And I think we're seeing a bit of a resurgence in some of the reactive oxygen PDT because they can target it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think some of the limitations there are how deep is the tumor.
Right.
And our technology, again, just in preclinical trials, hopefully it will stimulate quite a big increased interest. That's what we're hoping.
It's very exciting.
Because we have no idea. We have no idea how, you know, attaching known drugs onto these particles could even enhance more some of the immune responses.
Yeah, no, there's obviously there's a world of potential developments there. One more question. Your particular agent, I mean, some of the agents that have been developed for PDT are remarkably non-toxic, aren't they? So how does yours rank in that on that scale?
Ours, I would say, at high levels can cause cell death on its own. And we're working at a level that's, I would say, one-fifth of the dose that could start to cause cell disruption. We're down at one-fifth of that. Every cancer that we've tested with just applying the agent by itself, we know where that dose, that dangerous dose, would be from the studies in the Petri dish, and we're well below that. We were well below that in the Petri dish studies that we then translated to the animals.
So does that mean, rather like regular PDT, you can easily repeat the process if it's deemed necessary?
Yeah, we believe so. We would believe so. And I mentioned earlier nitrobenzaldehyde. It sounds like a toxic substance, but and it's so high levels it could be. But it's metabolized pretty rapidly. So the liver is the source of degradation of all your alcohols and your aldehydes, right? So any of the compound that is not absorbed into the tumor would immediately go to the liver, and much like PDT, would probably be completely cleared within a matter of a couple of weeks. We wouldn't have the photosensitivity in our PDT that's associated with the reactive oxygen, because we're using a wavelength of light that is not as, you know, when you walk out in the ambient sunlight, you're not going to get 980 nanometer light penetrating 7 centimeters into your tumor. We do that with controlling the power on a laser.
Right. So what you're saying is that people would be able to come in as a day case, have a treatment, and go off, and that would be that, and they shouldn't expect particular side effects from it.
Right. And the other scientific question that we're asking in the preclinicals is, say, for example, we injected a patient that had a breast tumor with the drug, and it was absorbed into the tissue. She may come in for a treatment. She may be able to come in a week later, and we could sort of reactivate those particles. How long do they stay in there and active? We don't have to keep giving injections. If we can dose it just right, we could even show if a patient needed several treatments for a large tumor, they would just need one application of the drug. They can walk around outside and do anything they wish, and then come back at a time frame that says within this window, that initial injection of the drug and the particles that are inside that tumor, you can continue to activate them.
Interesting. Okay, and I think I read some pretty extraordinary statistics on the sort of cell kill level that you're managing to achieve in your trials.
Yeah, we're pretty impressed with the percentage of cells that we kill in 90 to 98% of the cells that receive the drug and the light die within 3 hours.
Pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, and that's been consistent across the board with all the cancers that we've looked at. And again, that's exciting because, you know, some of the cancers are obviously more aggressive based on some of their cellular properties that make certain chemotherapeutic approaches less effective.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Again, I should tell you, audience, I was not trained in cancer. I was trained as a neurophysiologist, and I studied neurons in the brain and how they dealt with acidity for babies that died from sudden infant death. So I got very good at measuring pH in cells.
Okay.
And I was trying to find a way to make these neurons acidic on the inside. Right. And everything I looked at, I didn't see anything that worked. And so I kind of came up with this approach for a different reason. And then a graduate student asked me if I ever screwed that up. He said, did you ever make them more acidic than you were supposed to when you were trying to develop it? And I said, yeah, why? And he goes, I don't know. It seems like it could be valuable. So 3 years ago when I did that, I realized that cancer exploits pH regulation in a way that no other cells do. And I could find a way, and with this talented group of students at UTSA, to take advantage of exactly what cancer has evolved to be good at, regulating pH. And we're just turning it right around on itself.
Well, it's very interesting because in parallel to your work, of course, there's a lot of work going on with another sort of hallmark of cancer, which is this different metabolic system that it employs for its energy generation. There's so much work going on in that field, which again is similarly, it applies to all cancers. So it's got huge potential to help vast numbers of people. If you can get a hallmark process like that, which is really a signature, if you like, of cancer, then you know you're onto a winner when it comes to dealing with the large numbers of people who are suffering.
Right, and our excitement comes from the fact of what we've seen here coming out of the lab, that we can kill any type of cancer at really, really high rates. We're about to launch into some more animal studies that, you know, when we get it into the clinical setting and then sort of employ the expertise of the oncologists and those caregivers, we think we'll fine-tune it even more. It's really attractive to think that you're developing something that could be an option for people that don't have options.
Absolutely. It's fantastic. One last question. How long do the treatments last? I mean, first of all, you inject the activator. How long do they wait before it's ready to be exposed? And how long exposure do they?
Well, what I can tell you is that in our initial studies, when we injected the agent directly into the breast tumor, we injected it. We didn't do the systemic injections yet, so we have to work out the time course for that. But once we injected the drug, we waited 1 hour.
Yeah.
That was designed to allow it to be taken into the cells. And then the light treatment was 2.5 minutes.
Right.
And then we just sat back and watched, and we saw the tumors have a response to it, and it was pretty encouraging, pretty exciting stuff to see.
I bet. Yeah, you must have been thrilled. Okay, well, look, we're just about out of time, and as a last word, I mean, PDT, as I've always thought, is an extraordinary treatment with huge potential. It's never really made it onto the big stage, you know, when it comes to treating cancer. It's a bit of a sideshow. Do you think that your discoveries are poised to change all of that?
I hope so. I remember going to an R&D sort of question and answer thing from some people in the pharmacy industry, and I walked up to one of the gentlemen there, and I said, "What would you think if I told you I developed a photodynamic therapy that could kill any cancer?" And he said, "I would think you're a liar because that doesn't exist." So we're pretty excited to, you know, we have a lot of work to do to fine tune. Like you said, your questions were fantastic. We have something here that could be, like you said, this platform technology that could be really beneficial to cancer patients. So that's our goal. That's, you know, that drives us every day.
All right. Well, I'm excited to let people know about it. And I wish you the greatest fortune in developing it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me on.
It's been a real pleasure. Well, I have to say that I think Dr. Gadavin really is onto something. Whether the immense and devious forces at play in medicine ever allowed to become a presence in our hospitals is quite another matter. Dr. Gadavin expressed one of the biggest obstacles to progress in medicine clearly when he quoted that our investors don't want it to be cheap. And to be honest, I think that is its main stumbling block to widespread use here in the UK. It's simply too cheap, and therefore it threatens too much of the status quo. I'm talking about jobs and business. Thanks for listening today. Links to material relevant to today's show are, as ever, on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife.org.uk and click the link to the show that's on the homepage. And while you're there, check out our upcoming annual conference, which is on the 25th of November in London. And if you're interested in supporting our work as a charity and keeping fit, sign up for the first Yes to Life 10K run in East London. Lastly, a reminder that there's an app available for listening to UK Health Radio on the go. Click the link on the UK Health Radio homepage to get the app. Goodbye.